Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And welcome to a live edition of Midrats. This is one of those fun Midrats where we don't have guests. We don't have a specific topic. It's just a free-for-all. A melee, however you want to look at it, something for you to avoid going outside in the heat for, which everybody, at least on the East Coast, is having a good time. I think my friends in Eastern Europe are having a little bit of a chill, so if they wouldn't mind sending some of that our way, we would appreciate it. But if you'd like to join us, suggest a topic, or ask the usual questioners a question, we've got the chat room open at the bottom of the page. You can feel free to jump in there. We'll monitor that at the course of the show. If you want to do any taunting there, you're more than welcome. And we do like to extend this invitation if anybody is so inclined and would like to call in with a question. You can call the switchboard at area code 347-308-8397. That's the same phone number you'll actually see on the show page. So it should be fairly straightforward. And we'd love for you to come and join us. So, hey, Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal. Have your sidewalks melted yet?
They're working on it. I am, however, if it makes it through the microphone. Like all good Southern gentlemen, I do have my iced tea in a glass. And I do not believe that one should have sugar in your tea. I'm a little bit of a radical as such. I prefer my unsweetened iced tea. So I still have all my teeth, unlike some of my relatives. So I do not have cold tea with sugar in it. I have it unsweetened. I think that in your part of the South, but in my part of the South, one is allowed to forego such luxuries. We save it for moonshine.
Many people from the North do not understand when they order iced tea down here that you have to specify unsweetened. Otherwise, you will get something akin to syrup with tea around it.
It is. I used to drink full sugar Coca-Cola. I used to love sweet tea. And then when I was a young man, I spent some quality time with a triathlete, and she did not believe in refined sugar whatsoever. And being a nice Southern lady, she insisted on drinking unsweet tea, and it converted me really fast, and I've been in unsweet tea ever since then, which is maybe while I still have my girlish figure, I don't know, but I still have most of my teeth.
Well, then that's because you haven't had my wife's pecan pie, because as far as I can tell, it's just super saturated sugar with some pecans in it. So
now, is that pecan pie or pecan pie?
It's pecan.
Yeah, I don't know who in the South really calls it pecans, but there are some.
I don't know. You can get in a lot of trouble in many parts of the South for saying whatever the other thing is. But, yeah. At any rate, we probably ought to talk something about national security and maritime issues.
Yeah, because I was about to go into Cairo syrup, but this really isn't a cooking show. We want to hear about that. But
You got to get the dark Cairo. By the way,
exactly. This is everybody could put this as a multicultural training for the month. For those who aren't from the South, you can check that block and get your credit, however that may be. But we did advertise that we were going to talk about maritime subjects, and I think we'd probably be not serving our fans, so to speak, fan service, as they say in the movie business, if we didn't talk about what has some people rather excited, other people rolling their eyes, and people like me who are just waiting for more cards to get pulled out. That's a very interesting tit and tat going between Britain and Iran that started, I believe it was maybe even the 4th of July. It was definitely the first week of July at Gibraltar. The British seized a Iranian tanker that went around Africa and was headed to Syria at Gibraltar, and they knew nothing was going to come from that. And we saw about a week later, HMS Montrose managed to scare off the usual suspects in their go-fast boat. Really, they're more look more like cigarette boats that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has. They were going after a British tanker. The Montrose showed up, and they swished away. But they found a little bit of a lower-hanging fruit last week, and the British-owned Stena Impero, I believe, was it. There's a great video out there. If people haven't seen it, that means you don't follow me on Twitter, so shame on you. But it is out there. You just Google search it if you want to. But they got video of the Iranians doing a not bad fast roping job. They took the ship and up north it goes. I heard the latest excuse. They're saying that it was involved in a collision. Who knows? But we all know what it is exactly going on here. And I think the reactions have gone, and I think this is unfortunate because it just tells me to understand what the tanker wars actually were. It's not a repeat of the tanker wars by any stretch of the imagination, because there's not an Iran-Iraq war going on. Nobody's slinging Exocet missiles around or anything like that. I think it's just it's diplomacy by other means, almost using mafia tactics. You know, that's a nice group of tankers you've got going in my coastal waters. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. So that's kind of what I think is going on here. When you look at, you know, your diplomatic, your informational, your economic, and your military, I think the military has really got to be down there. Let the diplomats and the sanction guys push this. I think the Iranians, they just want sanctions relief. They want attention. I don't think they want to start anything more than that, because that's really a fight that in the end game they're not going to win.
Yeah, they the Brits were enforcing, actually, in Gibraltar, were enforcing sanctions against importation of oil from Iran or anyplace else into Syria. So they were actually complying with international law. This, of course, coupled with the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and the addition of additional sanctions against Iran, and 85%, I think, of Iran's government funding comes from their oil exports. They're a little miffed. They're probably and I think that they have learned lessons from the Russians and some other folks around the world are going to use little green men, although in this case it's the IRGCN. They're going to find flimsy excuses to stop shipping that is not Iranian shipping from leaving the Strait of Hormuz without being harassed. The latest thing I've seen is they're now threatening to stop all vessels that transit Iranian waters for environmental checks. Further demonstrating their the fact that there are sanctions being imposed on them. And, they're going to take on they may not take on the U.S. directly, but they're sure going to go after our allies and anybody else that they decide they don't like. And they're going to make things uncomfortable for a lot of folks. Now, the Saudis, I think, have reopened a few of the pipelines that go to the Red Sea. So they may not be as impacted as some of the other countries that export without such pipelines. But it's a call for both the other countries that are in the surrounding. We talked about this, I think, last week with John Kuhn, that the other countries around the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf, need to get their nice little boats. Many of them have nice ships that designed to do exactly what needs to be done here, escort other ships out of through the transit lanes. The difficulty is that there's that 21-mile-wide stretch of the Strait of Hormuz, which is split between Oman and Iran, and it allows for various kinds of passage under international law, but the Iranians have added some additional kickers in that, and things are going to go like this because they're going to try and pull the same kind of stuff that China pulls, which is we're going to violate international law and then we're going to lie about it and claim it was everybody else's fault.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. They're international law when it's convenient to me, and we'll negotiate it when it's convenient to you. But all nations are guilty of that to one state or another. Something I saw today that this guy has a radio show, Larry O'Connor. I guess as we don't have a Secretary of Defense right now, we just have an acting one. SecNav Spencer is acting SecDev. So there's a little bit of vacuum there. We've seen Secretary of State Pompeo kind of step into a couple of interesting lanes. For instance, Larry O'Connor, as I mentioned before, he interviewed Secretary of State Pompeo while he was in Argentina. And what he talked about is something that we heard a little bit in the news, which was about the international, building an international coalition to escort tankers through the Gulf, which would be interesting what they'll do and what caveats there will be on each ship if somebody wants to do a health and welfare environmental inspection, so to speak. But he said it'll be, quote, this is Secretary of State Pompeo, quote, it will be countries from all across the world that will participate in this. I guess, I don't know how long they're going to take to make this announcement, but I think it would be very, very interesting to see who comes out to play. Because if we recall from the Limp at Mine episode of earlier this year, that most of the stuff leaving the Straits of Hormuz is going to China, Japan, India, South Korea. And at least in the NATO side of the house, in the Western side of the house, we pretty much know who the players are that would, throw a frigate or two in the mix. But I'm really looking forward to see what nations and what ships are going to contribute and who on that list might be interested to come in to do a little bit of old school convoy ops.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think the EU they get a lot of oil out of the Middle East. Germany, Italy, Spain, UK, Netherlands, France to a certain extent. And you've left out Singapore as one of the countries that imports a lot of oil from the Middle East, but which also has a fairly vigorous navy for a country its size. Some of this stuff ought to be right up the European Valley. The NATO, what we used to call NCAP, Naval Control and Protection of Shipping, which was NSORG before that and is now some naval consulting of shipping or something, I can't remember anymore. But it's, that is basically the organization that sets up convoys and helps schedule these types of things. Taking that on, it's been a long time responsibility. Whether or not this is a NATO function, whether or not, and this, we're also going to run into some interesting questions here, because a lot of these ships, even though they may be owned by a country or flagged or a company in a country, they may be foreign flagged. You may end up with, like a Panamanian flagship, which is owned by, let's just pick a country, Canadians. The flag of convenience thing comes into play here, because who is going to defend the right of a Panamanian flagship to go through the Straits of Hormuz if it starts getting hassled by the Iranians over environmental issues? I mean, there's a reason countries, people, and companies use flag of convenience, but some of the downsides are that who are you going to look to for protection from this sort of thing? And as you may recall, during the tanker wars, and I agree this is different than that, we reflagged a bunch of Kuwaiti tankers to U.S. flag ships to justify some of our operations over there.
on the anti-piracy ops, the CTF-151, that was the multinational one, and those of us who were in Afghanistan and I believe Iraq as well, we all remember the national caveats list, where on paper you might have, 12 ships, but you can really only do your full spectrum of requirements with three of them. Just like you might have, 10 battalions in Afghanistan that are non-U.S., but you only got two that are worth anything. So I think as they build that coalition, I'm sure they won't share national caveats with us, but that commander, he's going to have an interesting challenging knowing, which part, which sectors are vulnerable to certain type of threats than others. I wanted to back up a bit because correct me if I am incorrect here, but as my U.S. Naval Reserve expert here on the show, we used to have, and perhaps we still do, but part of the U.S. Naval Reserve, we had units who maintained the corporate knowledge and expertise of doing merchant ship protection, convoy escort, however you want to look at it, just for circumstances like this where, active duty Navy doesn't do this as part of their workup, so you want to minimize the learning curve, but you could always get on the horn, and there's a reserve unit that's been drilling and practicing about this for, generations of reservists, and they go, yep, we're ready to go. Did we used to have units like that, and are you aware whether we still do?
Yeah, we did have units like that. In fact, I was in units like that for quite a while in my reserve career. It still exists. Apparently, it still exists as elements of some headquarters command, and a lot of merchant mariners end up in the. I mean, they've changed the designator for these. For the merchant marine guys that are in the reserves, but a lot of them end up in these units, and it's now called Naval Coordination and Guidance to Shipping, I think NCAGS, Naval Cooperation for Shipping, and so there are still some reservists. Most of them have, I believe, merchant marine licenses, but they're U.S. Navy reserve officers. And they would be the ones to help carry out this mission. There are also designated units in the Royal Navy and in a lot of other European navies that they have people who are designated to this, who may be, in fact, active or reserve personnel. But this, it has been largely a NATO mission. And that gets into a question of if it's a NATO job and you're not doing NATO operations, can you invoke that and get people to play, or is it going to be we're going to use the rules that are set up by through NATO to do this, and we'll pretend like it's quasi NATO or something. I'm not quite sure how that will work, but I'm sure it can work if they set their minds to it.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing because I follow a little bit of the British maritime chatterati, so to speak, and there's a fair bit of defensiveness about those who have made the observation along the old lines that it takes three ships to make one deployable, and we all know what happened to the Royal Navy in the last 25, 30 years, numbers wise, really the last 50 years, and knowing that they do have a good presence in the Gulf, but not that much. And the Iranians have a heck of a coastline. I was a little surprised that the British, and maybe they did in unofficial channels, asked for some plus up and some help. I know that there's probably some, knowing how Europeans work, there probably was a fair bit of continental NATO ha 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 related to Brexit going on. So I'm sure they slow rolled that. I've seen that play out before. Nobody could slow roll better than the continental NATO guy if they don't want something to happen. It's maddening to watch.
How true.
Yeah. But, the Brits have good friends in us, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders. But as with anything else, it takes time to to do that. Ships just can't be transported across oceans. And we are looking at a pretty quick timeline for the first week in July when the Brits took that tanker. But I would like to think that somebody at the maritime headquarters was, you know, playing chess and not checkers and looking three or four plays down the road, because this had to have been red most likely course of action. Not red most dangerous, but red most likely. I would be disappointed if the British planning staff, when they had identified that ship coming through Gibraltar, hadn't in their head go, well, we need to prepare for this, as opposed to what looks like happened, which is kind of hoping it didn't, and it did. I don't know. Maybe they just got unlucky, but it was a little predictable.
Yeah, when I was looking at this stuff, I thought, you know, this is a case where you could make the case for small warships, small fast warships that are adequately armed, unlike the LCS, say, corvettes, coastal patrol ships, you know, escort vessels that can accompany convoys or individual ships in restricted waters. And
are you talking about a ship that can do combat operations in the littorals?
Oddly enough, if you don't think a strait 21 miles wide is in literal waters, then you have got the definition wrong, because this is exactly where we should be using those.
I couldn't help myself. Sorry.
Yeah, and the Europeans have them. I mean, the Visbys and all those other things. They could roll some of those things down if they decide to do it. It depends on depends on whether we're really serious that we're not, you know, if not our ships, we're not gonna play the Iranian game. Now, you know, you gotta remember back in 2012, I think it was, I think President Obama, at least through General Dempsey, I think was then the head of the JCS, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I think he said that basically closing the Straits of Hormuz by the Iranians would be a red line, and we would take action to stop that from happening. I mean, that's in the Obama administration, and I know that doesn't necessarily flow through to today's administration. But, you know, for many, many years, we've warned the Iranians not to close the Straits. And, you know, and I think maybe the way they're doing this, which is pretty subtle, as I said, a little green men style, you know, we're pulling you in for inspection. We're pulling you in for, I think a few years ago, they pulled another British ship in and made them pay a fine for 5 containers that were missing or something. I mean, you know, this is the kind of nickel dime thing that's not quite at war, but it's just really, really annoying and wouldn't take much to go from what they're doing to a full state of war.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, you know, boil it down to human behavior. They're trying to, you know, perhaps, of course, reasons can change as things evolve, but they had to save face from the British taking their tanker. I guess, you know, maybe you can compromise and say, okay, the tanker can't go to Syria, but it can go back, you know, or sell their oil to the Danes or something. But then you quickly get into the argument, okay, are we establishing a precedent for the Iranians? Whenever they don't like something that somebody has done, all they can do is choke down without any repercussions in the Middle East. We're lucky at this point nobody has died, and without blood in the water, the diplomats and the politicians have room to maneuver. I don't think anybody wants to see bloodshed in this regard. So I think we've all been very lucky at this point, because all it takes is one stupid person putting a finger in the wrong stupid place, and things can spin out of control pretty fast. So, you know, let cooler heads prevail for a while, but we should be careful what precedents we're establishing.
Yeah, I think if we're going to have sanctions, you got to have sanctions. And if you're going to say no, look, we're not going to let you take oil to Syria because we're against the government, such as it is in Syria. You know, then that's one of those things that you have to sometimes you have to live with the consequences. And I assume that we've reassured the Brits that you know, we're going to back your play on this. But you know, there's some things we're not going to do. And I think President Trump, when he decided not to strike back at Iran for the shoot down of our drone, other than, I guess, my increasing sanctions somehow or whatever he's going to do, and I guess we took down one of their drones, you know, I thought that was a pretty savvy move on his part, because Iran is, you know, their country is not united necessarily completely behind the mullahs. And the mullahs are, you know, they would like nothing but more than a little stirrup that they can start raising the banner of nationalism and our great Iranian honor is being threatened again by the great Satan and its assistant, like the UK.
Yeah, and they have a history of the British, too, as almost everybody does. But the Brits have the lead on this, and I think you brought up a good point. Regardless of what people might say of certain predilections, I don't see this president being inclined to want to start another conflict anywhere. That's especially coming up to an election when that's one of the things he ran on. So I think he's going to let it play out. And, you know, I mentioned earlier about unfortunate that we don't have a Secretary of Defense, just an acting one right now. So Pompeo's got to fill the gap. You also got to look over at the Brits. They have a lame duck prime minister. I think it's pretty much set that Boris Johnson's going to take the reins here next week, maybe. I could be wrong. But his charter is going to be nothing but by Halloween, make sure Brexit takes place, however it does. Now, he's not going to want to get involved in anything, any way, shape, or form, whether it's, you know, like Paul asked in the chat room about if there's any covert operations that could signal that the Iranians have gone too far. I don't think anybody wants to do that right now. The Brits would be the ones that have to take the lead, because, frankly, unless somebody asks for our help or we decide that we want to be the traffic cop in the Straits of Hormuz, we don't have a dog in the fight quite yet. It really is Britain's move, and Britain will do what she wants to do. And with everything else going in the background, I don't think the Brits are going to want to do anything but talk and find some way for everybody to save face so people can focus on other things. But Iran will find something else, because they're in a tough spot right now of their own making due to the sanctions. Hopefully we can use the events of the last 6 weeks to push some of the wet noodles on the continent to get a little robust with sanctions, because they are biting. And it's really the best thing if you want to steer Iran into a direction that, you know, we want them to go, by letting the Iranians just do what they want to do.
Yeah, the only problem is that the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese, they're really good at driving those little wedges between allies. So, you know, everybody signs onto these sanctions, but you know, that's until their oil flow is restricted enough to cause a difficulty. And you know, so I'm just curious as to how long some of these brave hearts. Who's the what's the Monty Python guy? Sir Brave Chicken, no, Brave, whatever his name was. Anyway,
Brave Sir Robin.
Yeah. So you know, how long before one of them goes, well, we can't deal with this. We're not gonna impose sanctions. But you know, we'll see. We'll see how people are going to respond. Whether if oil continues to flow to China, and they don't get harassed, maybe things won't matter that much. If you know, I mean, I see a lot of forces at play that I'm sure that in the murky crystal ball in which you and I gaze, we just don't know what all the forces are. But I see kind of things afoot. I see the Venezuelans now are beginning to they sent up an SU-30 or SU whatever it was fighter plane to track one of our EP-3s. You know, the Russians have got their fingers there, kind of encouraging Venezuela. And we know that because the Russian airplanes have landed and dropped off stuff for them. So, and, you know, the Chinese are going to do the Chinese thing, which is we're going to get what we want because we have 100 years of bad news that we'd like to make up for today. So.
Yeah, and I think with the Chinese, too, one thing that we need to do is to realize, and we've talked about it with a couple of really smart guests on the show here over the course of the last 2 years. You can't look at the Chinese and the Chinese motivations the same way that we look at British, French, Russian, even motivations. The Chinese have their own way of doing things. They don't have no issue with corruption. They've got no issue throwing money around. They have no issue, kind of like the Russians do, with making people offers they can't refuse. And that's why they can do interesting things in parts of the world that you look around and you go, there's no way we could do something like that for a variety of reasons or any of our traditional allies. For instance, I've only seen it in the Pakistani press, and I think the numbers are a bit exaggerated. You could probably move the decimal point over. But one of the things that caught my attention this weekend was, I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation, even though I've flown over it a few times. Gwadar, G-W-A-D-A-R, in Balochistan, in western Pakistan. Announcement, you know, that it's no surprise the infrastructure improvements China has put on that port. But the article talks about by 2023, the Chinese plan on having 500,000 Chinese nationals living there at the huge production that's going to be going on to support it. A little mini colony there. I guess Chinese are building their own Hong Kong and Pakistan. But I think probably the decimal point is one to the left on the high side of that. But the Chinese do have a habit of, instead of employing locals to a certain degree, they will bring their own people. They've done that in Africa on a small scale. I think Ghana is one of the places that they're already into six figures, Chinese nationals who are there. And one thing about Balochistan, the Baloch themselves are not very welcoming to outsiders, which are usually other Pakistanis or Afghans. They don't, and one tribe doesn't like themselves. If any Western nation proposed to move 50,000 to 500,000 of their nationals in the next 5 years to any place in that type of the world, there'd be riots all over the place. You know, but just like with the Uyghurs being imprisoned by the million plus, put into re-education camps, which means having them apostate from Islam, there's no protest in the Arab world, and you have to ask them, the Muslim world, not just the Arab world. So you got to ask yourself why. Follow the money. Follow the threats. The Chinese are operating by a different playbook. I don't think that we can or really should try to pace with. Smarter people than me are going to have to figure out how to work around the Chinese because they're playing a different game.
Yeah, it's a very, as I think you described it many, many years ago when we first started the show, it's a very long game. And, you know, we change governments every 4 years, maybe every 8 years. And policies change for us pretty regularly. And so we have a fairly short game that we play. And the last one game we played was against the Soviet Union, that we were lucky. There was a joint Democrats, Republicans in power didn't really matter. It was kind of a joint view of how we needed to play that game, and that policy carried through until the end of the Cold War. And you know, we need to have some long-term thinkers like Keenan and some of these other folks did in looking at the relationship we were going to have with Russia, and think about what we're going to do, because we now the end of the bilateral power world into this multipolar world is it's very complicated, a lot more complicated than it was in 1970, say.
It is, and I don't think it's, you know, the old cliche about, you know, change being a dragon, ignore it, fight it, or ride it. Your only option is to try to ride it. And I though occasionally I have my, shocking, I know, occasionally I have my fits of negativity about the future. Usually it has to do with economics, but I don't buy into this decline of the U.S., decline of the West type of thing. I think it's the relative differential, perhaps, might be it, where we are used to having a certain multiple of other nations, like China, and that multiple is decreasing and about to reach parity in a few measurements. So, yeah, you could call it relative decline, but we haven't been declining. We continue to have a robust economy, a robustly growing population. That's not really what's going on. It's just other nations are coming from a very, very low level and growing. And it's not just China either. It's something every human should celebrate. And they were just focusing. I know the numbers in China are even greater, but in India, in the last, I don't know, about 15, 20 years or so, over 200 million people have been brought out of extreme poverty. And it is, it's still a very, very poor country. But there's a difference between extreme poverty and just poverty, or approaching the upper and lower class. The ability to send your kid to school has a multiplier effect for the future. So, yeah, I think we're going to see more challenges from countries like China and, you know, perhaps India at some point down the road. But I think we should see it as not something that we've done per se that's negative for us, but just other nations who have been underperforming for a couple of centuries have, through taking advantage of systems and medical care and technology that other nations have developed, just like we did, that they're starting to rise. I think the challenge is going to be making sure that that rise is understood. And when that rise develops claws and teeth, it's checked where you can. And I think people are trying to do that, but I think there's also a large cohort of people who see any type of relative change as an actual change. And I think it's more good news than bad news.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to me that India and China both have benefited from the relatively open markets and the freedom of navigation that allows products to be moving in and out. And since India has mostly abandoned its socialist efforts, that they have dragged so many of their people out of poverty. Same thing happened to China. There are just so many people, though, that it's, you know, you can pop a couple hundred million people out of poverty, and you're still got a few hundred more million, several hundred more million who are not doing all that well. But the only way out of this is to allow freedom. And China seems to be reversing that trend by the way they're trying to control their population. I don't think India is in the same boat, but we'll have to wait and see on that.
And hey, we have a regular guest here that's calling in with hopefully it's an easy pop quiz. Like to welcome on the show via phone, Jerry Hendricks. Good afternoon. Welcome to Midwest.
Good afternoon. Sorry, I kind of got in on this conversation a little bit late. I got pulled off on something else. You know,
That's okay.
The first
part of the show we discussed the difference between having sweet tea and unsweetened tea, and the difference between pecan pie and pecan pie. So you didn't miss much.
Well, I mean, definitely sweet tea is about the only way to go, especially if it's made in the sun. And I don't know about you, but it's pecan pie is the proper pronunciation. So, but then again, I guess no sense to go over till ground again. Just to pick up on something Eagle One was just talking about there, we are really seeing two things happen. One is we're starting to see a real challenge to the global manner in which we've been conducting trade and the ideas, the underlying assumptions of trade that have been around for, 400, almost 500 years since Grotius published in 1609. I mean, we're really starting to see China and Russia push back against that and say, look, we're not signing up for your system. And that's coming at a really bad time for the world because, you've got 53,000 commercial hulls out plying the world's oceans, and they are being protected by less than 1,000 ships of the United States and its allies and partners. And so you want to talk about the thin blue line, giving all deference and respect to the police officers and our first responders, the thin gray line of our navies to uphold this, 500 years old tradition of free seas and free navigation. It's a really thin line right now. And the Chinese are coming. They're coming with numbers, and they want to remove the system of governance, and they want to impose a different one that's more advantageous to their worldview. This whole situation with Iran taking the tankers in the Gulf is really just a manifestation of what happens when you allow your fleets to fall off and you no longer are there to police and provide presence in this global system.
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point. You make an excellent point, Jerry. And I think the other aspect of what China is doing is the way they treat their fishing fleets and the way they are intruding on so many other countries' exclusive economic zones and violating the other countries' fishing areas. It's incredible how brazen they are about it.
And how will you enforce those rules? I mean, the other nations don't have the Coast Guard. They don't have the white hulls. They don't have the gray hulls. China's out there, and because it's a centralized state, they're using their fisheries, their militias, their Coast Guard, and their active Navy in a way that we have not seen. And quite frankly, we haven't seen this sort of challenge to an established system since really the British began to establish the system 350 years ago. So, I think largely strategically from an intellectual standpoint, we're not prepared for what's going on right now. And we're certainly not prepared in terms of sure holes and numbers and how you're going to police and govern the system that we've spent so much time establishing.
You may not have caught it from early on in the show, Jerry, but let me bounce this by you. Recently, in an interview by Larry O'Connor with Secretary of State Pompeo, who's down in Argentina, we talked a little bit how Secretary of State Pompeo is kind of stepping over a variety of lanes while we try to get Secretary of Defense established full time. But he talked specifically about the efforts that are being made to build up a, lack of a better phrase, if not a convoy system, a protection of the sea lines of communication through the Straits of Hormuz and exiting the Arabian Gulf. And he said, quote, "It'll be countries from all across the world that will participate in this," unquote. And we talked a bit about, with the Limpet mines, and when you actually look at what's coming out of the Gulf, a lot of that has changed on where it goes in the last 30 years. And a lot of it's going to China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, places to the east. specifically China, but if you wanted to comment on other options, perhaps including the Indians, do you see the Chinese perhaps stepping in and joining such an entity?
Well, I mean, I think that they're going to offer, certainly what they've been doing with the counter-piracy patrols in the Gulf of Oman and so on, demonstrates that they're interested in establishing themselves. But I think we need to be cautious as to why they are establishing themselves. They are wishing to gain additional experience. They want to know how fleets operate together. They want to know how we are going to operate. And so a lot of this is an intelligence gathering for them, as well as an experience gathering for them. The Chinese are very anxious to actually establish themselves in the Arabian Gulf region, because they see themselves not only as the primary customer, growing primary customer now, of the Gulf's petroleum and energy supplies, but certainly in the future, they want to have, essentially a monopoly control over that, which is something that European allies ought to be concerned about. My concern, and this is based upon some statements that have been made by senior administration officials about, you know, why are we there given our energy, independence now, is that once you leave, once you cede control or a mission, to the other guy, it's not like we can turn around in 4 years and poke our nose back in there. As badly burned as I feel by the experience in Iraq, it does not mean that I want to pull chocks and pull out of a region that's geostrategically critical to the world. So, to the degree, I don't believe the United States can act in partnership with the Chinese, because their views on rules of governments are opposed to ours, which means we may have to work alongside them, but not necessarily in partnership.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I guess one of the questions we were kind of rolling around is, if these, there are so many flag of convenience ships out there, and I'm not sure whose government is going to decide, well, we can escort the Panamanian flagships, but we can't escort Marshall Island ships or whatever they're going to do. I mean, it's not a NATO, unless a NATO nation is under attack, it's really not a NATO mission. So this is going to be, if Secretary Pompeo is putting together some kind of alliance, it's going to be interesting to me to see how the nations are going to assign their forces to carry out some kind of escort mission. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, I do have a thought that comes up immediately when you made the statement about the flag of convenience fleets, because yes, there's a lot of flag of convenience fleets out there who, ship owners who have reflagged their vessels based upon, which nation state can give them the best tax advantage, because they don't like paying taxes in the United States or Great Britain or some other, former maritime power. And yet now, that we're starting to see some of these ships being seized on the high seas, suddenly there's a desire by the ship owners, as well as by places like Lloyd's or London and the insurers, they want to come up with a security system. And so I think, we can go back to the late 1980s reflagging of the ships in the Arabian Gulf at that point in time. And it's kind of interesting to go back that when those nations reflagged their vessels with U.S. flags, for that period of time, they paid U.S. taxes. And given the conversation we have about the need to grow the size of the Navy, maybe some of these merchant companies, might want to look at the idea of contributing to the nation that's providing them with security. So I think it's going to be we may see a public discussion and dialogue about these flag of convenience fleets and which side of the bread is better for them, and then ask them to align themselves with those arrangements.
Hey Jerry, I don't want you to feel like we're kidnapping you or anything, but
I thank you for your time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you calling in, but before you go, I figured, being that you are in close, though you're not there right now, you spend most of your time in close proximity to the Potomac Flotilla and everything else that's going on there. But, without digging too hard into what happened to Admiral Moran, but We do have a new CNO coming up. Vice Admiral Gildy is going to have to go through the confirmation process. He's a little bit of an unknown to most people. What's kind of the back of the cocktail napkin few things that listeners should know as they look forward to what Vice Admiral Gildy might bring to the table as the new CNO?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not personally familiar with him, nor have I worked with him in the past. He really is, a dark horse candidate. The one thing I do know, and this is from my personal perspective, is that when I heard the rumor that they were going to look at a three-star, I got my May issue of Proceedings, looked through the flag list, looked at the 41 three-stars that were there. I think there were 40 that were still on the list because one had retired and one had been promoted to be Vice Chief of Naval Operations. And as I reviewed the bios of the remaining three-stars, Gilday quickly emerged. You know, he had numbered fleet command, i.e., it was 10th Fleet, which meant that he had cyber background experience. The fact that he had commanded a carrier strike group struck me as definitely a positive because, oddly enough, a number of our recent chiefs of naval operation had not commanded at fleet or strike group level, and that he had also been a surface warfare officer, which, given the collisions and the material and readiness issues of 2017, you know, I had hoped that the Navy would look for a SWO in either the chief or vice chief position. And so, you know, as I looked at, you know, I remember I circled, you know, his picture in my Proceedings, and that was sort of my pick. I there was two others I looked at as potential candidates. But I'm kind of excited that you have a three-star that's able to rise and perhaps make a fresh break from the past. I think if the Commandant of Marine Corps' new planning guidance is a sign of what happens when you go down to a three-star and bring somebody in who is unexpected and fresh, then I would be very excited if Admiral Gilday does something similar as what the new Commandant has done. Then I'll be delighted. But, you know, I'll be waiting to hear his testimony along with everybody else to see if there's any indications of his direction. But I'm excited to have an Arleigh Burke option exercised and for us to go deep and pull somebody up.
Yeah, I was on active duty the last time we did this when they called up Admiral Zumwalt to take over CNO. And
I was old and we had just landed on the moon.
Well, you know, I'm a tad older than you two. And it was an exciting time. The trouble that he faced, though, was the entrenched powers that be that were resistant to the kind of changes that he was attempting to bring to the fleet. And so I don't know how successful or not we view his CNO-ship, but it was my first, it was a real eye-opening experience for me to see that, you know, how resistant the bureaucracy is sometimes to sweeping change.
If there's one thing that I am hopeful for is that this decision to go for Admiral Gilday is a sign that the secretary and the secretariat is once again asserting a strong leadership in the Department of the Navy. I think too long, there's been too much deference given to the uniformed leadership and sort of a continuation of cycles of changeover of leadership. And it appears that the secretary did stand in personally on this to select Gilday. And I know that between the secretary and the undersecretary, there's been a lot of drive for new innovations, you know, education reform and so on. I hope this is a sign of continued civilian, assertion of authority and looking for some change strategically in the service.
Yeah, I share your optimism, Jerry. It's, you know, sometimes you just need to break the adhesions, and you and I have talked about this, you know, reaching down. A one-star is a little hard to do, but reaching down to a three-star, get a fresh start, fresh ideas. And I'm also aligned with you, the Commandant's planning guidance. I think his counterpart to the other services is look at their staff and go, well, what do we got? So I think this might turn into be a very interesting last 6 months of the year of people thinking hard about hard topics, and we can look at what of those ideas might be useful to move the needle in a positive direction.
Well, thanks for having me on.
As always, great pleasure, Jerry, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, and unsweetened tea is okay, too.
And, yep, Jerry's gone, and we really appreciate him calling in from his vacation to join us today. We just got a few minutes left, Eagle One, and to kind of pick off that vibe, I don't know whether you've had a chance to look at the Commandant's planning guidance, but for those that have not, tomorrow morning over at my home blog, another former guest here and hopefully future guest, Brian McGrath is going to be guest posting his observations on it at my home blog tomorrow. And at the bottom of that, I will embed for the listener the full report. And I encourage everybody to read it. If you want to find out what Brian McGrath wants to say, you have to read the post tomorrow. But I do hope that this could lead to a little bit of positive competition amongst our senior leaders, because how many times have we talked about with our various guests about give us a strategic plan, give us a vision so we can talk about, as opposed to just doing what we did because we're doing it because we can. And oh, by the way, do you want to talk about sequestration? So this, I think this hopefully is not a one-off thing that we're going to see more along these lines.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting to me that because I'm not sure this is driven by President Trump, but some of the other people in the administration, people who come from industry tend to look for that vision. You know, where are we going and why are we going the way we're going, as opposed to we've always done it this way. So I really think that a positive view of, you know, just even if it's the wrong vision sometimes, at least you get you started on a path instead of just fumbling along the way you've gone. And that's a lot easier to present, I think, to Congress, is here's where we want to be in X years than just we need money for one more ship alt on the USS Umpty Squinch.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's the easiest thing, is to go in there and think you're just going to talk to congressmen about what can benefit them and their district. But there are congressmen out there. Representative Mike Gallagher is one of whom. How I found out about the Commandant's new guidance was from one of his tweets. I had no idea. But he's not alone. Representative Banks is another one. There are a few senators along the same lines that are interested in more than what is their parochial, will just give me another 450 votes in the following two districts to vote for me. They're smart, dedicated patriots who really want to help us get better and to not repeat some of the mistakes we've seen the last two decades. But they can't do it by themselves. They need something to hang their hook on, and I think this is serving as one of those opportunities for people to hang their hook on. And so, you know, we'll see. I will note this. Vice Admiral Gilday, he is a 1985 graduate of the Naval Academy. So let's make the assumption that because he's fairly young, the next CNO will probably be about his same age too, maybe a little bit older. So we are potentially looking at, and no offense to my illustrious cousins, we're probably looking at the last or the second to last baby boomer as CNO. And so when Gen X takes over, maybe we'll be able to wear a black leather jacket. Wait, that's service boss is already wearing a black leather jacket. So there is, we're getting the junior cohort of the baby boomers are now reaching the higher levels of the Navy. I think it's fair to say generations don't matter. I think that's more true than not true, but it does give people a different perspective, a different career experience, and different ideas about our nations and its sailors. So, you know, the change is always there, but that's just one little transition point that we're coming to that I just thought was interesting.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. I think, for example, my older son has been in the Navy since 2001, and so he's 18 years, and we've been at war one way or the other since the whole time he's been in, and I think that's unprecedented in our country's history. I mean, we've always, you can call the Cold War a war, I guess, but for full combat operations for a period of over 18 years, and we, you know, even before then, can start with Ernest Willen. We've been fighting a long time, and that experience is a lot different than people who came in, say during the Jimmy Carter years, and right after the fall of the Soviet Union, where they, you know, they were looking at peace dividends and all that stuff. And, you know, the world that my generation and then probably even the early part of the next group grew up in is completely different than the one that the current generation is living in. And I think that makes a huge difference on your worldview and your expectations of how things should be.
Yeah. And it's only going to get more interesting. We were teasing you earlier on this year. You know, you've reached a certain age when your kids are 05, but my youngest, her best friend's boyfriend is coming back from 9 months with the Air Force overseas, and just a year older than her. And, you know, she was born in 2001, so we have people now who are just now joining the military and enlisting or going to the Naval Academy who all they have known their entire life has been the slow, low boil conflicts that we've had since 2011. So it's your experience does inform your view of things. So it's that's good, but in a way kind of sad and disturbing at the same time, but that's the way time goes.
Yeah, but it's also interesting that we have so few people. I mean, I can't remember what the percentage is of how many people who are currently or have served since 2001 in the military, and how the vast majority of Americans have no idea what life is like for our sailors on board ship, our Marines and soldiers in the field, our airmen and Coast Guardsmen doing their jobs. I am, as you know, unalterably opposed to the draft, but I do think we need to do a much better job of explaining to people what it takes to be a military person in this day and age, facing the things that they face. And I'm hopeful that the Top Gun movie will not lead to another conversation I used to have where people would tell me, well, if I decided to join the Navy, I would have been a Top Gun guy. Every trial lawyer I ever met said that, because they're all egomaniacs. But you know, and I think we really need to do a much better job of explaining ourselves. Hopefully, the small cadre of people listening to our show get some benefit from our discussions. And with that, we probably need to close this thing off.
Yeah, we do. We got to save stuff for future shows. Yeah, I was about to go on a screed about the second and third order effects of BRAC, but I probably put everybody to sleep. I will say this for everybody: Next week, we touched on NATO a little bit today, but next week we're going to have George Benitez on again as our guest. It's kind of our NATO update. He's a very, very, very knowledgeable person on NATO and all those good things. And even though he went to the University of Florida, we won't tease him too bad. So that'll be our guest next week. And Eagle One, it's been a fast hour as always. And do your best to survive the heat and have some tea and some pecan pie.
Yeah. No pie, but certainly will be enjoying some nice cold beverage.
Perfect. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today for a free-for-all Mid-Rats. And until next week with our guest George talking about NATO, hope you have a great Navy Day. We'll see you then. Cheers.
Yeah.